Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. In this episode, I sit down with stand-up comic, actor, and author Tom Papa. When Tom Papa gave me a super advanced copy of his forthcoming book, I was really flattered. Then I read it, and I briefly considered suing for plagiarism. We expect comedians to riff on their own lives, but whole passages seemed like they'd been written when he was hiding behind the couch in my living room. Then again, what else did I expect? He's a comic who spent years observing us, and then pointing out all the ridiculous things we've missed about ourselves and our everyday lives. Which would be kind of mean if it wasn't so funny and so true. Tom draws on the stuff we all experience, but manages to see it through glasses that most of us aren't wearing. Now, Tom's always been a funny guy, but twirling a banana peel while shaking your hips to a Glen Campbell song for a classroom full of second graders doesn't guarantee you a career in comedy. In this episode, we talk about what did. It involved hard work, the right pair of shoes, and some help from another comic you might have heard of. But more than anything, it took being himself. And that's never as easy as you think. And once you get success, how much is enough? Despite finding his way to a great career, he still feels the nagging need to win over everybody in the audience, Russian crossing guards included. So pull up a chair and listen in.
Hello, Tom.
Hello, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for bringing me down.
You know, I just finished reading your book, and I think it's a very, very advanced copy. So I appreciate you giving it to me, but I think people can probably pre-order it fairly soon. And it's, you know what it is? It's, when I was young, I had this fantasy that I would create sort of a life manual, like an owner's manual.
And I,
in my 20s, because, you know, you're trying to figure things out in your 20s.
And no one helps you.
No one helps you. And I thought, well, every time I do come across a good bit of wisdom, I forget about it.
I like that idea.
Yeah, I liked it. And then that went away in my 30s. And, you know, and then I had kids. And now my kids are at the age where they are getting complicated.
Yeah.
And again, I start having this fantasy of the owner's manual
right.
to pass on to them.
Yeah.
Right? And when I was reading your book, I feel like in some ways, you've sort of created that.
Yeah, well, the idea for the book was that as a comedian, I have been studying your family for 20 years. Like, that's my job. I observe everything about you and your life and your family and your uncles and your cousins and your mom and your dad and your wife and your husband. And here are some things that while you're living your life, you might have missed.
Right. But that's kind of crazy because we would assume as an audience for a comedian that we are hearing about your unique life and we are finding humor in the fact that that's your life. But in reading your book, I found passages. You talk about your wife being the wash your hands lady and you are the weatherman.
Right.
Meaning that she runs around behind your kids and you telling everyone...
Wash your hands. Did everybody wash their hands?
And she wakes up in the morning and asks you, is it going to be cold outside? How cold is it going to be? And,
right.
Well,
every day.
That seems lifted right out of my house.
Well, that's the thing. That's why your instinct of writing the manual was correct. Because we are all the same. We are literally all the same. And we all try and live these unique lives and have different kinds of weddings, and raise our kids differently, and live differently. And then you realize at the end of the day that billions of other people are doing the exact same thing. I mean, that's why, you know, literature works. Like, if you want to feel grounded in the world, just read books, just read other people's stories, because it doesn't matter who they're talking about. It could be a different sex in a different place. There is a human element to how we deal with our certain age and the certain people in our life, and it just grounds you. That's the reason I want my kids to read more than anything.
Yeah.
I don't need them to be smarter. I'm not trying to increase their vocabulary. Just feel what it is. You're not alone. There's being a person is a hard thing.
You know, you say this thing a lot in your stand-up. You say that everyone thinks that having more money will solve problems. And
I have to keep going. I have to keep running. I have to keep chasing. I have to get more.
Right.
You move into a bigger house in a nicer neighborhood, and you give your kids more stuff, and you do all this stuff, and everybody's happier. You see everybody running around, and they got their rooms and doing all this stuff, except for you, who's now sitting there like, I just put myself into the same position I was in when I was 22.
Right.
I now have bigger bills, bigger responsibilities, bigger stuff, and at a certain point, it's like, can't we just live in a nice little place and be content and live in this?
Right.
I always feel like it would be nice to live in Greece, like the guys, the old men with the espresso cups and their bellies are out in the sun and just. But when you want to make stuff and create stuff, you have to keep running. You do have to. And it's not just for money. But money is kind of a motivator to keep you hustling and keep you going. You know what I mean? Like, I really feel like until my kids are out of the house, I really have to work super hard.
Well, I think that's also, if you've done that your whole life, it's the way you define yourself.
It really is we should be busy. We should be working hard all the time. I really believe that. I feel like I don't think about retirement or think about my times when I'm not working are my most stressful, confusing, the most,
Yeah.
I remember watching my kids starting out once they were able to walk. And I'd be sitting there with my coffee in the morning. And they would come marching into the living room and go to their play kitchen set and get out their play hammer and start going to work, making pretend eggs and pretend juice and bringing it over to you. And they're like little waitresses. That's like our instinct. Like, that's what human beings, you have to keep busy. You have to keep doing stuff.
Yeah, there's not play sets that involve like a couch and a remote.
Right. There's no lounge chairs for toddlers.
Yeah.
No. It's all little cars and briefcases and going to work. And I really feel like that is where we're happiest as human beings. I really feel that.
I think often of what my job really is.
Mm-hmm.
And my own definition in my head that I don't verbalize that often is very different. And I think about your job, which people would say, oh, he goes to a theater and he gets up on stage and he makes other people laugh.
Yeah.
But if you had to describe what you actually do for a living to an alien, like how do you define it in your own head? Like, what is actually your job?
Well, you kind of got it. It is kind of that. It is to, ultimately, it's to go make people laugh.
Right, but the work.
But the work behind it, I would tell you, Mr. Alien, is I watch everybody who's living and having a hard time and filled with stress, and I point out the things in their life and make them laugh at those things.
So do you think, okay, here's a chicken and the egg question.
Okay.
Do you think that you
chicken.
Were... You're a chicken, definitely. Do you think that you were an observational person by nature, so you became interested in comedy? Or do you think you were interested in comedy because whatever, you got a charge out of it, and so you learned how to be observational?
I would say it's observational. I think that happens first. And I take that from watching my nephews and my nieces and children. There's a sensitivity that I see in some of them that I had. Like, there are some kids that notice, like, some of the kids don't notice anything. They're just having fun and doing whatever. We're in a restaurant and they're just coloring and whatever. Then there's other kids that are like, why is that woman sad? Why is that guy angry? Why is that man looking at it? That guy's talking about it. Like, they're hypersensitive of the world around them. And I remember being like that. And then when I learned that being funny, you know, which probably happened pretty closely after that, I could make fun of those people. I could imitate all those people because I was watching them. So I knew how that guy talked, or I knew what someone did when they hit their head or whatever. I was storing all that stuff up without knowing it, I guess, and then using it to be funny, I get is. So I guess it's the observational part probably was first.
Yeah, because I think, you know, when I was young, I was really little and I was a late bloomer, and anything I could do with my brain or by making someone laugh or doing anything
yeah.
might keep me from being hit or being put in the trash can. That's probably how comedy starts for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Like, did you go through any of that?
Yeah, you know, I was insecure and I was scared of grown-ups and I was, you know, teased by other kids at times and, you know, all that stuff. And it is kind of, you just want to belong. When you're a kid, you just want to, just like me for something. You don't like me for my head, you don't like me for my belly, you don't like the way I talk or chew. Do you like when I make this fart noise? Oh, well, that worked. All right, so I'm going to keep doing that. I'm going to keep making people laugh and do stuff like that. And I remember it's distinctly like the seventh grade summer was the first time that I was hanging out. Well, everyone in our town went to camp. They all went to camp. It all dumped out. And they went away for the summer, except for a handful of us that didn't go to camp. And we all hung out at the local pool and stuff. And it was me in seventh grade and all of these eighth graders, eighth grade girls and boys. And I did not belong with them, but I had a summer ahead of me where these were the people I was going to get to hang with. And I had to fit in. I had to hang. And I remember consciously that summer making them laugh.
Really?
Using it. Like using that I was funny before that, but I was using it as a tool. It was like, the girls like me now, the guys are cool, I can hang at the pool, I'm in. I'm not cool, I'm not big, I'm not like these guys, but I'm the funny one, and I'm just, every day was working it.
You found your thing.
Yeah. My first comedy bit was in second grade in Mrs. Mayola's class. And at the time, a song was Rhinestone Cowboy.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Like a Rhinestone Cowboy.
Glenn Campbell.
Yeah, that was a big hit. And this was in the middle of class. It wasn't playtime. It wasn't like, let's do something for the talent contest. I remember taking my banana. I had a banana peel. And I walked up into the front of the class, and I twirled it around and sang like a rhinestone banana, and shook my little hips and twirled this banana. And the class fell out laughing, and I did the song. And the teacher she let it go a little bit. She must have been like, why? This is bizarre, but I'm going to watch for a bit. And then she took my banana and sent me back to my thing. And I was charged up. I just made a class of people laugh. No one asked me to do it. No one was... You know, that was the first like bit that I remember. So why are you doing that? You're doing that because you just want people to like you. You want them to laugh and like you. If they're laughing at you, they're pretty much gonna like you.
You sort of went up and found an audience.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Right off the bat.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to be a headliner. It's so silly.
Did your parents, like, were you aware at a certain point that this could be a profession?
Yeah, no, I remember distinctly finding it out. In this one summer, I went to my friend's house, and all the older kids were playing, my friends across the street were playing Let's Get Small by Steve Martin.
Oh, yeah.
And they were all like, you know, eight kids, all boys, just in this room, listening to this album and just laughing. And I was already funny, but I didn't know this could be a job. And now you're sitting there with this album cover and like, this is a man who's doing this. This man, this is what he does? He's like my dad. He's like a man. And this is his job? My dad puts a tie on and crumbles out of the driveway every day. What is this? And then I went to my other friend's house the same week and heard, in his basement, heard George Carlin's Class Clown. And I was like, all right, now this is a man who's dressing like a child and is swearing. And I mean, this guy's not a man, but he's the age of a man, but he's not a man. And I was like, all right, so this guy's doing the same thing that guy's doing. These are people, could be a job. And I really was like, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I had no personal roadmap for that, how to do that, how to become that man.
Right.
We come from a very large family filled with, you know, salesmen and fireplace installers and insurance salesmen.
So what did you do?
There was nobody in my family had any kind of show business background, or that wasn't something that you did, that's something you went to go see.
Right. There's the disconnect.
Yeah. No, yeah, that's a whole nother world.
So what do you do in that situation as you're getting a little older and you're becoming obsessed by it?
Yeah, you just kind of keep sniffing around. And my senior year, I was an athlete, so I was always in sports. So I was making people laugh and doing stuff, but I was also the class clown at the same time, and I was like, all right, let's wrap this part up. There's no need to put a helmet on.
Were you playing football?
Yeah, I was playing football. And I'm like, there's no need to continue with this. I think we've gone as far as we're going to go. I could go maybe a small school and keep playing, what, for 4 years? But I specifically went to a college that had lost the rights to have a football team. They had cheated or done something. This was Ryder College in New Jersey. And we went to tour it, and that's when I learned they have no football. And I was like, I'll go here.
Now, why? No, because you didn't want to be tempted, or because your parents had an expectation?
Yeah, my father was really, really talented football player, and okay, he played Division III, and he really loved it and was better than I was. You know, he was really tough, and I knew if I went to, like, a Hofstra or, like, a place that had it, there'd be pressure to go do it. And Ryder had a theater department, but they didn't have football. And I was like, all right, let's go here. Let's take the pressure off.
So did you feel like you had to come up with a technicality so you didn't let him down?
A little bit. I was navigating it for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. He wasn't hard. He was, you know, he was a little disappointed, but we had a good time together. We did it from kindergarten until 12th grade, but I wasn't like the angry jock guy, you know. I was taking popsicle sticks and making little faces on them and turning around in class and doing a whole medley of Stevie Wonder, Michael Jackson, doing bits. I was always working it. There is an interesting picture that I have of our, like, final game. We were Pascack Hills, and on Thanksgiving you'd play Pascack Valley. That was, like, the big ultimate, you know, rival. And you'd have this big game around Thanksgiving. It was the final game of the season. And I remember, like, there's a picture of the whole crowd of before the game, all the guys screaming and yelling, "We're going to kill them! Let's go!" In a big pile. "We're going to kill him. We're going to kill him." And I am standing. They're all here, and I'm standing next to it. I'm the captain, but I'm standing next to it like, calm down. let's play, but...
This is high school.
You're not really feeling this, are you? Come on.
So were you trying to, like, write stand-up or write comedy
time, too? I had this notebook someone had given me. It was the gnome notebook. It was like a denim-looking thing. It had a little gnome on it. And it was just blank pages, you know. There wasn't, like, paper source where everybody had, like, these cool stuff, right? You know, like these cool journals and stuff. And I didn't, at least. And I had that one notebook, and I started writing jokes in it.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. And I remember reading them and thinking, like, there's a couple funny, but there's a lot that aren't funny. Like, I know what I want to say, but I can't say it.
Oh, that's fascinating.
It was a little frustrating book, yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder if it exists still, but I remember not being able to do it. I wasn't able to write funny. I was funny. I was making people laugh for a long time.
So you were instinctually funny. You could
yeah,
in the moment, but you couldn't harness it. Like,
yeah, and there's some people I know, comedians, who would tell you a totally different story that nobody knew they were funny in high school, and they didn't even know, and then it just came out later. But for me, I was funny. If we were had our sleepovers would have been hilarious. Sitting in the dark, your dad's yelling at us, making fart noises, and telling funny story. I mean, it was funny. But then to sit with a book and be like, how do you write a joke? How do you write a funny thing? Oh, there was like a lot of, yeah.
Did your dad
bordering
understand?
On poetry.
You're right. Did your dad understand that idea of a profession or support it? Or, like, would you talk to your parents about
it? No,
that?
You know, it was like they really wanted me to go to school. They wanted me to have an education and not...
Was there a plan B in place for you, even in your own head, of like...
No, I mean, there wasn't. There was my mother had this small advertising agency, and when I first got out to make money, I worked with her. And but I knew, like, I'm not going to go get a job in a real place in the city. that's going to pay me a lot of money and keep, because I know I'm not staying here long.
See, I think that's fascinating. to at that age, know that enough to turn down an opportunity like that for something that seems not only low percentage,
yeah,
but there's not even really a direct path for a way to do it.
No, you're just finding the way. Yeah. But I knew that that other way wasn't right. Like, I just knew that that wasn't me. I didn't know how it was going to happen. But I remember I drove into the city once. I mean, going to school in New Jersey, and they got me an interview at Bozell Advertising.
Right.
And I drove up. I put my suit on and my hard shoes and drove from, you know, 2 hours into New York City, which is daunting, like getting through the toll and parking and finding the elevator and all that stuff. When, you know, you're a junior in college, it's just like... And I went and I had a meeting with this guy sitting in his cubicle. That wasn't a cubicle, it was an office, but a very small office. And he was chubby, so it looked even smaller. He was just bursting at the seams on his shirt. And he's sitting there and he's asking me, do you want to be an account guy or do you want to be a creative guy? And I'm like, I don't know, they both sound kind of good. Well, you got to choose. I mean, which one's it going to be? Are you going to be an account and you're going to service the people? Are you going to be right and do all that? And I'm like, I don't know. And he's just like kind of pissy. And I'm looking at this guy and I'm like, I just drove all this way and to become that. Like, is the goal to, like, if I get the job and in 15 years, am I, of that hellish drive that I just had into the city, is the reward being him? Is that going to be the that's something wrong with that. And I drove back home, and I was living off campus in this house, and I had play rehearsal. And I came back, and I took off this hot, grown-up clothes, and I put on my Converse All-Stars. And I went to campus, and I'm walking across the parking lot on my way to rehearse. And I was like, that's it. There's no way I'm putting on those hard shoes and going to work in an office. I felt so free and relaxed, and the Converse All-Stars were a big part of it. And I'm just bouncing across the campus. I'm like, this is what I'm close. I'm getting there. This is... insanity.
I mean, that takes a certain amount of confidence to just say, I'm going to ignore all other doors and I'm just going to go for my thing.
But when you look practically at what it takes to do anything in any business, really, but in show business, you know, because so many people flood into it, that the odds are so against you, that you really just kind of, I don't know how it happens unless it draws you and makes you go. I had to think about whether I wanted to go into advertising. I didn't have to think about making you laugh.
So how did you take that GNOME notebook and figure out how to transfer from the guy who could be funny at a slumber party to a person who could... Like, how did you teach yourself your craft?
Yeah, because I was acting in school. There was no stand-up. But I knew that that's where I wanted to be, was a stand-up. And I remember seeing there was a comedian... from our college, was playing in a comedy club near the school.
Okay.
And I was like, okay, so he's done it. He went that way. You know, like, again, like, you're just looking for ways to go. And I had a job working as a security guard in Princeton at night. I would have to sit in my car in the winter in a housing development. And I would just pull my car up and run a wire into a heater in my car. And I would sit there with my sandwich. And a radio that could record stuff, and I'd watch TV on this little TV thing, and I'd just sit there for 6 hours in the middle of the night and hope that nobody came, and no one was coming. It was Princeton. But I had a recorder with me, and I started recording jokes. I thought I was doing stand-up, and I started recording little rants and stuff, and then I would come back and play them for my friends, and they did not think they were funny. They thought... you've got to stop this job. You're going crazy out in this in your car by yourself. But I was starting to, I was starting to hear it. I was starting to say it. And I did I went to my cousin's wedding in Tennessee, and we all had to say something. And I was one of the only cousins that made the trip. Me and my uncle Al drove all the way down, and the window broke, and it was windy. We couldn't get the back window going, and we were just driving, and I think the radio was broken. So when we got there, my uncle said, you drove down with Tom? He said, Tom and about 12 other people, because I was just doing voices and just, we're going crazy in those long car trips. And so, but we all had to stand up at the night before the rehearsal dinner and say something. And I did a Larry Miller joke as
my
little speech.
Do you remember what it was?
Yeah, my cousin was really handsome, successful guy, and women were really attracted to him. And that he was getting married was a big deal. And I said, this is a big step for Jimmy because, and this is the joke, women are attracted to Jimmy like cheap metal to a magnet. And the place fell out and they all laughed. And I remember I was buzzing. I was to the point where I remember laying down in the hotel like, that's a joke. That is a constructed, that was so fluid and natural and had a real punch and you really said something. And I really think that helped my, I think that kind of opened, there's a structure. Like I kind of.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm one of the only young people, it was all adults, and they all laughed. You know, that joke related to everybody in the room. You know, I can't tell you exactly why I was buzzing so much, but I was. I was going to sleep like I had told a real joke.
Yeah, because
I was funny with Uncle Al going down, but I told a joke. That's a difference.
I mean, is there something that stands out for you as when something clicked where you go, oh.
What really started to help was when I was hosting shows, and I was in New York and I was hosting these shows, and that, like I was getting laughs and I was writing jokes and I was doing the thing, but then it was kind of hosting, you're talking like we're talking, and hosting and weaving those jokes into us talking made it more natural. It allowed me to be brave enough to be myself while I'm telling these jokes on stage. And then that slowly, it's about beating down fear. It's about being able to be up there and completely be yourself.
What does that mean, to be yourself? Even when you're telling a joke that you've crafted and made, like, because you're not up there just saying whatever's coming off the top of your head.
No, so. But I'm saying it as me. It's not, in the beginning, you're playing a little bit of a character.
Okay.
I would do this hard, there's a tape out there of me in the very beginning. I was 30 pounds heavier, I had long curly hair, I wore tight shirts, very tight jeans, and I would do this thing where I would kind of lunge, kind of like Elvis in a way, like kind of like one leg out, and I would just tell these, I would kind of like rest like this and tell these jokes and go 100 miles an hour and it was all fear. I just didn't want them to see me. I didn't want to give them any kind of opportunity to respond. Like I would never sit on it. I would never just tell the joke and sit and relax.
You just didn't want a heckler to get a word in.
Full speed ahead. Get up there, go as fast as you can and get off and hope that they laughed. And it was all fear. And so to go from that guy in his crazy little, my wife calls it my crazy brother, doing stand-up, to becoming a person that is just me. There's not that much of a difference talking to you now and being on stage. I'm planned out and I know what I want to say when I'm on stage. But I'm pretty close to this. It's not that different.
But it sounds like it was much harder to learn how to do that.
It takes a long time. It's an intensely scary endeavor, being a
stand-up. Why do you think it's so scary? Do you think it's so scary because of your own inclination to maybe tell yourself you're not good enough, and so anything you hear may feed that?
Sure.
I mean, is that what it is?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. And it's you. It's like they're saying, no, I don't like that guy. I don't like the way he's talking. I don't like his jokes. I don't like his point of view. It's not Pee Wee Herman. It's Tom Papa. We don't like you.
Which is the opposite of how it worked when you were young.
Yeah.
Which is when to be funny was to be liked.
Yeah, right. And you still want that. I mean, there's comedians that have a thing where they don't really care if the audience likes them or they're not likable, and they don't make eye contact with anyone in the audience. They look over everything. I have a very different, I still want to be liked. I still, if I can see you, I don't like seeing them, the audience, but if I can see you, if light's spilling off, or in clubs you can see a lot more of it, I kind of make eye contact with almost everybody.
Now, do you do that thing where if you find someone that looks like they're not liking it, do you work on that
yep.
person? You do?
Yep. Yeah. And I know it's not right and I shouldn't do it, but I want to win them all over. There's a crossing guard at my kid's school.
Yeah.
This Russian guy, and he all last year did not like me. I don't know what it was. Every time I pulled in, I'd be like, hey, make a joke. Nothing. Just, and my kids were just like, it's killing him. It's killing dad. He can't get this guy to laugh. He can't get him. And this year, I got him.
How'd you get him?
I don't know. I went out of my way in the orientation days, give him a couple jokes about the parking structure, and I got him. And now when we walk in, he's like, hey, and I just wanted it. I wanted it. The same thing when I would go golf with my uncle, and I don't really golf anymore, but we would go golfing, and we're two, and they always put you with two other guys. You got to go out in a foursome.
Right.
If I couldn't make one of those guys laugh, it would drive me crazy. I'm going to be with this guy for 2.5 hours. We're going to be out there for 3 hours. And my uncle would laugh because I could keep trying. There's still a thing in me that wants to win you over.
No wonder you don't play golf.
I'm not one of those comics who can sit there with a cigarette and be like, screw you if you don't get me.
You're not Stephen Wright.
No, I wish I could be.
Well,
I
it's funny hearing you say that because I thought before you came in, I bet Tom feels an obligation to have to be funny sometimes. Like, if you go to a dinner party, it's like, oh, this is, you know,
yeah.
You're meeting some new people, and it's like, oh, he's the comedian, so.
Yeah.
Or you know, you respond in a text message to somebody, you got to have a funny response because you're a comedian.
It's true.
But hearing you talk, I mean, do you feel ever obligated, or do you almost feel more like you need to do that?
I need to do it, but also, you know, I'm a man now. I'm a grown up.
Yeah.
So
you
I
are.
Shouldn't feel like I have to do it all the time, but I do feel like it's my job. It's my responsibility.
Right.
If we're in a pitch meeting or if we're in a school meeting, we were back to school night last night and we're sitting in a little gaggle of parents in between Spanish and math. It's my responsibility to be a little funny here. No one else is going to do it. No, right? I mean,
do you also have a self-critic going, like, stop doing that? Like, do you ever step outside of yourself?
I don't want to be like, I'm not on. I'm not, hey, I'll talk to you. I'll be normal. But I'm going to get a funny line in. I'm going to break this social construct. I'm going to puncture this.
Right.
Right? I'm not going to let this stand. As we're all just going to be grown-ups here. I'm going to call out this situation in some subtle way, not obnoxious, I'm on, but I do feel it's my responsibility to pop the balloon and make people laugh. It's kind of my job.
And I think that what I respond to in your work is this ability you have to see situations that societally are normal.
You
but
know.
That when you pull out those filters, watching that human behavior is actually really strange. Like,
yeah.
You talk about going to Cheesecake Factory and the tradition of ordering dessert and the way the server comes around to tell you about the dessert.
Yeah, the presentation.
The presentation and everything, which we've been ordering dessert since we're little kids. We've
yeah.
seen our parents do it. And so all that behavior is normal, but you have this ability to pull the curtain back and go, I can show you a way to look at this situation that will make you never see that server coming up to offer you the presentation of dessert
right.
the same way again.
Well, it's really just coming from, it's not so much I'm going to pull the curtain back, it's just these dessert people are driving me insane.
Is that how it starts?
I can't sit, I cannot have, every time I go out to eat, the woman comes bouncing up to the table, did you save some room for dessert? Huh? We've all seen the act, lady. We've all, come on, let's go. I mean, aren't we all tired of this? I'm not the only one, right? We're all, these people are coming up and saying, are you done working on that? Why is everybody saying, are we working on our food? It's the most disgusting phrase. Aren't we all tired? That's how I feel. I feel like, all right, am I alone? Or is this really driving you as crazy as it's driving me crazy?
Right, and looking around at your fellow people going, aren't you seeing this?
Yeah.
But they're not half the time, right?
They're not, or they are, or they're just, it doesn't manifest itself in humor. It manifests in stress. And now I'm yelling at my kids to stop coloring and get in the car. And they don't realize that it's the dessert lady that caused this you to bubble up a little bit and cause your heart rate to go up.
What's the evolution of the process?
It's got to drive me a little crazy.
Yeah.
I've got to start being naturally upset about it. And then...
Do you have to notice you're upset about it and find a trend or...
It just kind of emerges. Sometimes if I'm desperate for material, I'm looking a little more. But it just kind of emerges.
Yeah. But I wonder what, you know, what you still run up against. Like where your own limits that you find. Like, what are you struggling with or chewing on that you still find you come up against?
I'm not as popular as I should be. I work hard. I feel like I should be selling more tickets than I am.
Really?
Yeah.
But that goes back to the thing. I mean, I think you're peaking right now.
I might be. I might be.
Yeah, how much is enough?
I don't know. I would like to be better known for my craft.
Right.
I would like to not have to tweet that I'm going to Eugene, Oregon. I would like them to put up Tom's coming to Eugene, Oregon, and it sells out.
At the border.
I just don't want to, yeah. I don't like the chasing people and letting them know I'm around.
Right. You just want to all be, come
I just
to
want
you.
To be just big enough where 3/4 of the place is filled up without me having to make a call. That's all I want. That's like such a stressful part of it, you know?
Yeah.
Having to market and do all that kind of that part of it.
Do you feel there's a new pressure on comedy now? Because first off, it seems like everyone is doing it or wants to do it or is inundated with it on social media at all times. And this idea that everything moves quicker now. Material gets, you know, you write stuff. I think if I were in your position, I would feel like, you know, I would always have to come up with new things. Like,
yeah.
I think in the 80s or 90s, maybe you could have an act and you could tour that thing around.
Yeah,
and
for
that
years,
thing could
a whole
be,
career. Once guys would get 45 minutes of material, and that was it. And I like writing. I really like exploring and finding new stuff to talk about, and I like that part of it. So I'm naturally doing all of that. I know what you're saying, like, the culture seems like it devours a ton of stuff.
Yes.
Much quicker.
Yeah.
And comedians are feeling that, and that's why people are trying to put out specials with this frequency that even George Carlin couldn't do.
Right.
And lesser comics are putting
out.
Then
the quality goes down. Right?
Way down. I call them premise specials. There's a lot of specials out there with really great premises. This guy is up there, he's a talented comedian, and he puts a special out. And these are really unique, funny premises, but they're not fleshed out. And if he had just waited another year, this would be a great special. But people feel an urgency to put stuff out, that they're putting them out early, and all you've got is a premise. I call them premise specials. Not to say mine are, you know, the greatest specials of all time, but I am conscious of putting them out too early. I want this thing to be done. And there's that, you know, there's a thing to stand up where a joke that has been in your act for 5 years just keeps getting better. It just keeps getting, there's a confidence, there's this something going on in your subconscious that is delivering this with such confidence and such relevance that these jokes really get great, like great, they age. And the putting specials out all the time is not allowing these things to age.
Right.
You know, it's drinking the wine the year it comes out. There's a difference.
Right.
But when I met Seinfeld, he was coming into the clubs when I was coming up. He was done with the show and he came back to New York.
Yeah, tell me about that. Because I did read something about the way you met him and the way he sort of mentored you, right?
Yeah. It was a huge thing because you're young and you're in New York and you're trying to do it and there's all these different guys. You see Chappelle up there with a cigarette. It just seems like it's coming off the top of his head. And you see Dave Attell and he's just late nights just down there drinking and telling jokes. And I wasn't that way. I wasn't that guy. I knew I had to work. I was like, I don't know. I feel like if I even have coffee before I go on stage, I'm a little different. And I feel like I need to write and go put it on stage and then come back and work on it some more. And I don't know. I don't see many guys doing that, but I feel like that's... And then Seinfeld shows up and he comes in and happened to run into me a couple times in this 1 week. He was scoping out the clubs before he came back.
Oh, so after his TV show,
he had been
out of stand-up for so long just doing the show, and then
he was doing it in the summers during his, from what I know, he was doing it in the summers. He was keeping it alive, his act, but
yeah.
He wasn't really a pure just stand-up. He was doing this
sure.
crazy show. But now he's living in New York, and he's coming back to the clubs. He's starting over, which is a very humbling thing to do, I would imagine, in his position. And he's going back to all the clubs that he started, and he's going to go back on stage. And he was just kind of checking things out. And while he was checking things out, I was up at a club in New York, and he saw him come in while I was on stage. And I saw him come in the next night, and I showed him new material. I saw he was there, so I didn't want to just do the stuff I did last night. And I came off, and at the bar, there was no one in there, and he said, "You're really funny." And I was like, "Really?" Because I'm not feeling that right now, you know. And
where were you at that point in your own?
I was trying to get on Letterman. I was trying to get on TV. I had a little Comedy Central stuff, but I was spinning a little bit in the mud. And I needed affirmation that I could do this, you know. Am I going to, do I have enough to really make a really good career out of this? And he gave me the affirmation that I was really funny. He just said, "You're really funny." And he didn't have a lot of guys that he was hanging out with in the clubs. He had Colin Quinn, who could be really annoying. And he needed other guys to hang out with. And I wasn't annoying. And I was kind of like him. And he started, I just soaked up everything. I was just a sponge. I just hung around him and we had the same sense of humor, so I just hung around him, and we made each other laugh, and we became pals. But it's Seinfeld, you know?
That's like being a young baseball player and, you know, having, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, I'm trying to think of a non-steroid example. Babe yeah. Ruth comes
having
around
Derek
and wants
Jeter.
To be your buddy.
Having
Derek
Jeter come over
that's right.
and say you're good.
Yeah.
And it's exactly what it was. It's exactly what it was. And I just started soaking it up. And the real fortuitous thing was that he worked the way I thought I should be working.
Did you ask him about how he worked?
Yeah. I asked him, "How do you do it? What are you doing? You would come off and he would change one word in your joke. And, well, why does that matter?" And then he would have his pads and he did all the stuff. It was an affirmation that the kind of cobbling together way of working, this was a guy that had real success doing it that way. So I just started, it gave me real sense that I could be a comedian this way. I didn't have to get all liquored up. I didn't have to smoke and be cool. I could just go to work. I could just go to work and keep writing it and keep writing it. And there would be something good that came out of writing. And that was the biggest thing of the biggest help of him being around. And then word got out that he thought I was funny. That helped.
Yeah.
People at
Letterman. I would imagine that would help a little
that
bit.
That started to help. Yeah, I mean, he was so, it was, the series was just done. And just to be near Jerry was like, it was huge.
What did that affirmation do for your self-image? Or how did it change your, you know, like, was that a point where you doubled down, I guess?
Yeah, it gave me, it I don't know if this is a good analogy, but it showed me how to pull the ropes and get and really catch the wind in the sails. I'm out there kind of doing it, and he gave me confidence that, okay. And then I got better at it. Like, he gave me, like, tips in the craft, basically, and how to carry yourself, just how to be a grown-up and you know, have a family and do your things, and just how to carry yourself as a comedian. He loves comedy so much, like, really adores comedy. Like, I call him the comedy chiropractor. Like, whenever I would feel funky and be like, is this right? Am I doing okay? I mean, you call him, have one conversation, and he would adjust you and get you thinking, no, what you're doing is the greatest profession in the world. It's better than acting. It's better than straight jobs. This is, like, the greatest thing. Can you believe we get to do this? And just keep working on those bits. And if you get one new joke to work, that's going to give you all the rewards that life has to give you. And it just gave me a real sense of purpose and a peace of mind. The hardest part was I opened for him for years. He started bringing me to these theaters and go open for him. And you're flying private and you're staying in these nice hotels and you're just doing, there's no, like, getting liquored up. It's just like a schedule, and it's just so, I mean, it's the greatest gig. And going to these beautiful, ornate theaters filled with loving, adoring fans.
You don't have to reach out to Eugene, Oregon and tell people to come.
No, there's no tweeting, I'm putting this up for sale. It is the greatest gig in the world. And he used to say, you're going to have to go do crappier gigs on your own to go, you know. And it's true. It's like the temptation to stay around him and do those gigs was so great because it's the greatest gig ever.
Well, I could see why you said a little earlier about like, I should be more popular. I mean, that's quite a high bar to start out. I mean,
I have that problem.
The gifts are great, but also it's like you started in first class.
I started with a guy who, yeah, I started touring around with a guy who anything but sold out, like completely sold out. Like, we don't have one ticket left to give to your aunt who happens to be in this town. That guy, 5,000 seats in Atlanta, two shows, move on to, I mean, yeah, I come from that, seeing all of that. So when, if I walk into Eugene, Oregon, and there's nobody in the balcony, I feel horrible. I feel terrible. And I really, I started to have to ask, like, so when that country guy came in last week, how did he sell? How about you, you know? Oh, okay, so this is normal. Right. Seinfeld world isn't normal? Oh, I thought that was normal. But Jerry just keeps, for as luxurious as I make his tour sound, you cannot escape that you have to sit down with your pad and write those jokes and then go try them in a club and keep doing that. That never changes.
So whenever you write new material, the equalizer among all comedians is you don't know if it works unless you put it in front of a live audience.
Yeah.
There's no way around that step, is there?
There isn't. There's no... That's the problem with writing without performing. Like, I'll have, like, if I'm on vacation and I'm not performing with my family and I'll start writing, at a certain point, you've got a bunch of pages you want to try. You got to stop because you got to bring it up and it has to be evaluated and start editing and doing all that.
Right.
It has to be on stage. And, you know, when you're 60 years old and you're sitting there in your house, not a lot of guys want to get up and drive an hour to some club for 10 minutes of stage time. That's why comedians always gravitate towards each other. Not only are you, if you're around other comedians, you can say really inappropriate things and people will just laugh. If I say what I really want to say at back to school night, I'm going to lose some friends for my kids. There's that part of it, but there's also the constantly teaching each other, reminding each other of the lessons.
There's not a lot of things that many people can say, I love this at age 12 and it still sustains me in my mid-40s or whatever. What do you think it is about it that you keep wanting to chase or that keeps sustaining you? Like, I wonder why it is that it hasn't gotten old for you. You ever think about that?
Yeah.
Why it still works for you?
Yeah, I don't know. It's fun. It's really a lot of fun.
It's still fun. I think that's...
It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. I mean, think about when people pay to go see a comedy show, they want to laugh like every 30 seconds. Like even if you go to a really great comedy movie, if you laugh 6 times in 2 hours, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And then how deep are those laughs? But if you go to a comedy show, you're laughing a lot. People come out, their stomachs hurt, their face hurts. And you feel that from those human beings. And that's where you go to work all the time. That's where you do your thing. It's fun. It can be aggravating. I'm not Pollyannish about it. There's, you have your doubts. There's struggle to everything. But at its heart, it's just fun. You know, I call my comedian friends and go see them at a club. You're laughing a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I'm doing the same screwing around stuff that we did when we were kids. It's pretty great.
Did you ever almost quit?
When I very, very, very first started, when I was first starting out, the girl I was with, father passed away, and I felt like I had to take care of her. And I went to, I stopped going to the clubs. This is like the first 2 years. And I'd met Greg Giraldo, was my first comedian friend. And we were doing all these open mics together and stuff. And I just started concentrating on work and taking care of her. And I just felt like, maybe I have to just make money and take care of this situation. And maybe comedy's stupid. It's hard getting on stage. It's hard getting stage time. And Giraldo would call me every day at work. What are you doing? Where are you? This went on for like a year. I was like, I'll come back. I don't know. And again, it wasn't really a rational decision. I just gained weight. I was drinking beer all the time. I was playing video games with my friends late at night, like until the night, like before video games were like pop, we were playing hockey. And I was drinking and I was fatter and I was unhappy. And I remember laying on my sister's bed during some family function. I said, am I funny anymore? I just wasn't myself. It wasn't like, oh, I really should go back to stand up because that's what, you know. I was trying to live this other guy's life and he was a fat guy drinking beer. I didn't want to be, that wasn't me. I was supposed to be with Giraldo doing stuff, making people laugh and being a comedian. It's like you really don't have a choice.
God, that's what I'm taking away from this conversation is that, like, that's the only thing you
don't have a choice. Yeah, you just literally don't have a choice. You could try. I could just have been that fatso and won that tinfoil Stanley Cup a couple more times that we made, but I don't know. They wouldn't have sustained me. It just I wasn't happy.
Well, I think it's the definition of an artist to feel like every time you don't do that thing, your whole life falls apart.
You don't feel right.
You don't feel right.
Yeah.
That's the definition of an artist.
And yeah.
It is. All the rest is icing on the cake. The fact that
yeah.
You can make money at it. I mean, what I'm hearing you say is you'd probably be doing it regardless of the level of success, and I'm always inspired by people like that. You know?
Oh, I tell my wife all the time, like, you know, this is fun now, and we're getting the kids through school, but I could go back to that studio apartment we started at with our little futon. I could eat tuna 5 times a week, and I really don't think I'm lying when I say that. Like, I just really have joy in doing it. And I want to be really good at it. And I do want to sell more tickets. I would love to have, you know, an easier time with, you know, selling out Madison Square Garden. I would love all that. But more importantly, I have a lot of fans and I have a good career, but I just want to be as good as possible. I don't want people to say, oh, yeah, he was kind of hacky. He was, yeah. I enjoy working at getting good at it. And now, like, this book part of it, it was like, I really, like, you know, you're the first person that's read it. And it's like, Is it okay? Is it hacky? Is it lame?
You know what? It's great. It's great. And, you know, I appreciate being the first person to read it.
Yeah.
I like that. It's sort of a memoir hidden inside a book about comedy.
Right.
Or a book that are essays on family.
Yeah.
Comedically looking at family.
Yeah.
I appreciate you sharing, you know, sharing the inner workings of it.
No, it's great. I mean, people don't ask these questions, you know. People don't really ask really good questions about stand-up. They usually just ask, you know, some lame ones. So it's fun to talk about.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
This is the best. I love being here.
Well, you can stay.
I got stuff to do. I got to go home. I got bread in the oven.
Do you really?
Yeah, well, not in the oven, but it's fermenting.
Hey folks, that's our show for today. Thanks for listening, and I encourage you to check out some of Tom Papa's work. If you can't get to his house and try some of his fresh baked bread, you can at least go on Amazon and Netflix and check out his comedy specials, and definitely look into his podcast called Come to Papa. And definitely check out his book and pre-order it. I know we're a little ahead of the curve here, but the book is great. It's called Your Dad Stole My Rake, and it's hilarious. And if you want to read about Tom Papa right now, you can go to the off-camera store and buy his magazine. That's right, we make an exclusive magazine for each guest that comes on the show, and you can see them all at offcamera.com. Buy a single issue or try a monthly subscription. It's a great way to have the show delivered right to your coffee table. So check that out, and while you're there, you can also get a monthly subscription to the show, which allows you to watch all 117 episodes in our archive, anytime you want, on any device. It's a great way to support the show, so check that out. Also, check us out on social media. We are Off Camera Show at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And I'm Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. Or just email me. I'm sam@offcamera.com, and I'd love to hear any suggestions, comments, criticisms. Well, let's be honest, I don't really love to hear criticisms, but I do love hearing what your opinion of the show is. So if you got an opinion, send me a letter. I want to thank everyone that helps us on the show. Crawford Shippey, Laura Kemper, Nathan Shields, Michaela Galvin, Amy Jones, Cara Johnson. And a big thank you to Matt Davidson, who removed something really horrible from the back of the refrigerator this week. He's always good with the tasks that no one else wants to do, so thanks, Matt. And most of all, thank you. Thank you for tuning in and listening each week, and for being a part of this conversation. We love making this show, and we want it to get out to as many people as possible. So if you like what you're hearing, please tell your friends and spread the word so we can keep doing this for a long, long time. And in the spirit of that, make sure to tune in next week when I sit down with comedian, actor, and writer Nick Kroll.
My little philosophy leaving college when I moved to New York and was like, I'm going to go do comedy, was that regret was a lot scarier to me than rejection. And then I signed with this great brand manager, and he gave me that quote, that regret is a lot. That would be amazing. But I think I just had this thing of like, I don't know if I'm going to be a comedian. I don't know if I'm going to get to be an actor. But I know that if I don't try it, I will be lifelong bummed out.
You know him, or at least know some of his most famous characters, from his Comedy Central sketch series, Kroll Show, and his work on FX's The League. You might also know his 70-year-old alter ego, Gil Faison, half of the cranky duo that slayed audiences in Oh Hello on Broadway. He's also doing amazing work in films that aren't straight comedy, like Loving, My Blind Brother, and Joshi. You're about to know him for Big Mouth, the best animated show about puberty your preteen could ever watch, and one you'll never let them anywhere near. See you next time, off camera.